You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. In this episode, Reggie explores the meaning of a living lineage. This talk was given at the 2011 Winter Datun, a month-long retreat held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado.
Good morning. I wanted to talk this morning a little about this lineage, a little bit more. And, you know, it's tricky because I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, like we have the corner on the truth or like I'm trying to promote something. At the same time, there are certain things that need to be said. And, of course, it's from my point of view, obviously. It's from my point of view as a historian, that's my profession. I'm a scholar of religion, and my professional training at the University of Chicago in the history of religions. And I studied with some of the, probably the greatest comparative religionist of the 20th century, one of the greatest ones, Mircea Eliade. But there were others as well who were, you know, right up there. And so it was very unique. It was a wonderful opportunity. And then, of course, you know, my training with Trogyam Trungpa. So I'm coming at it with this interesting combination of the scholar's mind and the sociologist's mind, sort of through my whole life, looking at Buddhism and writing about history, but also in the process of making history, because that's what we're doing. We're making history, as you know, all of us who are Dharma teachers and Dharma practitioners. It's a huge, hugely impactful historical thing that we're part of. So that's been interesting for me to have the outside view of the scholar and the inside view of somebody who's actually involved in it. And so my comments really come from that. And also from, frankly, 40 years of being in the situation, being in the trenches and meeting and knowing and really, you know, being very close to many Dharma teachers, not just of the Tibetan tradition, but Theravada and Zen and Chan and so on. So Chogyam Trungpa, you know, at the time that we met him, that many of us met him, when I met him in 1970, it was very compelling. And what was compelling is interesting. In the beginning, we thought it was him, but now what I understand is it's actually his lineage. It wasn't him, it was lineage. And because the reason I know that is because I see your response to this lineage. And then I see your response to the senior Dharma Ocean teachers who are teaching in this lineage. And, you know, it's not about the teacher. I mean, the teacher is important, and the teacher plays a role. There's a certain karmic, you know, situation that needs to happen for someone to be a lineage holder and a teacher. But ultimately, it's really not about the teacher. And, you know, I know from my own experience that in the beginning, you do tend to put it on the teacher. It's natural, you know, because you're looking around and there's this person who's at the center of a certain situation. And I don't think there's a problem doing it, but as you practice and as you develop, you know, in your own journey, I mean, of course, you love the teacher. We loved Rinpoche because he gave his whole life to the Dharma. So you have that kind of very deep love and devotion. At the same time, you start to realize the lineage is actually coming through you. And I know you experience that too. Even if you've never sat in your life, it may be that during this datun, there have been moments when someone has been in trouble and something has come through you that's more than you. Do you know what I'm talking about? It comes through you and it's more than you. It's not you. And then you start to go, that's interesting. Maybe that's actually how this works, that when I'm in a state of openness and I'm willing to be a vehicle for someone else, I can do it. And I'm a vehicle of the lineage itself. And that's how it works. And what happened to you maybe in a moment with somebody who was struggling, and what happens when someone sits up here and teaches, there's no difference. It's exactly the same thing. The only difference is just the amount of experience that you've had. You know, you as you have more experience with more people, and more study and more practice, you know, you can hold more pieces of it. But the process is the same for all of us. Do you see what I mean? So lineage is really, really important. And lineage, I think, you know, finally people are, it's starting to dawn on Westerners, lineage is not official credentials. And this has unfortunately been a huge source of confusion in, you know, in Western Buddhism, modern Buddhism, that if there's a big organization and there's somebody at the top claiming to be the lineage holder, that's the beginning and the end of it. That's it. You know, that's the lineage holder. That's the lineage. But you see, I have a different angle on it, because when Chogyam Trungpa arrived in 1970 in the United States, he had no institutional position. He had been in England. He was the Trungpa Tulku, which is, you know, it's not one of the high tulkus, but it's a tulku, you know, and he had a monastery, and he had in Tibet, and he had responsibility for certain teachings, which is how it works. But he went to England, and he realized that parading around in robes, sitting on high thrones, people bowing down, you know, that's not the Dharma. It's not the Dharma. That's not the Dharma. That's a social form. And whether or not the person sitting on the high throne happens to be a lineage transmitter is another question. It's another question. Having the credentials, being the head of a lineage, and actually holding lineage are not the same thing. Are you hearing me here? This is really important. And the reason Rinpoche knew that was because his teacher, Chamgyen Kuntral, and he's the portly gentleman up here, he was Rinpoche's teacher. And he was also a tulku, again, not the world's highest tulku, but he'd been very well trained, and he was a deeply spiritual person. And he really didn't give a shit what anybody thought about his teaching. He taught the Dharma. And because of it, a lot of people didn't like him. Rinpoche's teacher, you know, a lot of people in Tibet, these lamas with all their retinues and all their power and all their monasteries, didn't like him. And meantime, his heart was the Buddha's heart. And he knew what he was doing. He was very direct with people, and he took it seriously that we have to transmit the Dharma person to person. It's not about sitting up on a throne and giving a good talk, or it's not about having a lot of fancy robes or having a lot of people doing prostrations to you. He understood, Chamgyen Kuntral, Rinpoche's teacher, the Dharma is about shedding all of our masks and living in a way that is totally direct with reality. And he trained Rinpoche in that way. And he was so direct that, you know, he would, even rich people who were patrons of the monasteries and patron of his monastery, because he had a monastery also, he would insult them. You know, he would say, I think you're full of shit. You know, somebody would come up and try to manipulate him and play with him. And mostly in Tibet, if it's a rich person, they get the highest teachings, they get to come to the Abhishekas. You think we have a problem in our culture that people with wealth get access to everything? Well, in Tibet, it was even more extreme. And you never think of insulting one of your wealthy patrons, ever. John Kuntral, that wasn't his world. That wasn't the world he lived in. His thing was, we are here to keep the lineage of the Buddha alive. And he told the truth, and he didn't care. Let the chips fall where they may. Because he was blazing with sanity and with love. Because he was so direct, it got to a point where the patrons wouldn't even give him money for food. They wouldn't even give him money for food. Here we have this completely realized person, and they had a problem at the monastery because the patron said, we'll give money to the monastery, but not for him. We're not going to give anything to him. You know, I'll give the money, but don't give anything to him, because he insulted me. So Rinpoche said they had to, you know, like get together. You know, some of the students had to get together, like, what are we going to do about this? I mean, this teacher is really a problem, you know. He's a great teacher. We love him. We our lives, but, you know, like, we need food for the monastery, and we need food for him. So they actually had to have a committee meeting, and they had to go out and find some people in the neighborhood who were willing to step up and make sure that there was enough food. We're not talking like fancy food. We're talking about barley and, you know, some vegetables and maybe a little meat once in a while and some cheese. We're not talking about fancy. That was Rinpoche's teacher. And there was one story Rinpoche told about him, that one time there was they were having a ceremony, and one of the, and it was small, it was just like, you know, the students and, you know, a couple of, you know, of the senior monks were there, and it was small, it was just, you know, maybe, you know, 10, 12 people. And one of the people was sitting there really, like, pissed off at Jamgon Kuntro for something. And he wasn't there. You know what I talked about yesterday when expectations? Well, this was that kind of situation where he came in and he wanted it a certain way and it wasn't that way, and he was really pissed off and he was not present. And Jamgon Kuntro is going along, and all of a sudden he took his, you know what a Dorje is? You know what that is? It's like, you know, heavy. He threw it at him, and it hit him right there and knocked him off his cushion. And the guy came back, and later he just said, I was so grateful because I was gone. I was so grateful to him. Meantime, he has this hole in his head. So that's the kind of teacher he was, Jamgon Kuntro. And I'm telling you this because this is this lineage. I want you to know where this lineage comes from. It comes from that. You know, you think we're tough here. Well, we are tough. And you think that we're kind of like, we push it too hard. Like, you need to show up here. You need to be here. You need to put your chips in if you're going to be here and practice with us. That is tough, but that's where it comes from, back there. Jamgon Kuntro really was Trungpa Rinpoche's father, in the sense that Trungpa Rinpoche's mother was just a peasant woman living in northeast Tibet, in the grassland. They were nomads. They herded, animals. And Rinpoche's father left before Rinpoche was born. And so Rinpoche never knew his father. In the meantime, when he was 18 months, he was brought to the monastery to be trained. And his mother came with him and, you know, was with him until he was about 10. So that connection was very important for him. But pretty early on, Jamgon Kuntro became his main teacher and really was his father. And at a certain point, Jamgon Kuntro felt that Trungpa Rinpoche really needed to go farther. And in the situation in the monastery, it wasn't good enough. He was working with Rinpoche, and Rinpoche was learning, you know, studying and practicing and so on. But Trungpa Rinpoche felt he needed something more. In terms of who he needed to be, Trungpa Rinpoche, there was this monk named Kempo Gangchar, who was also a student of Jamgon Kuntro. And Kempo Gangchar's story was that he also was somewhat of an orphan. I mean, most of the Tulkas were somewhat orphans, but he was really an orphan. He lost his mother and father, and Jamgon Kuntro took him in and brought him up, and realized that Kempo Gangchar was this very gifted, amazing person. And Kempo Gangchar was his whole life was the monastery, and his whole life was being a monk. And, you know, in the monastery, there are a couple of hundred of rules that are, you know, part of the monastic life is that, talk about a container. I mean, that container governs everything you do. And so in the monastery, Kempo Gangchar was he was fastidious. He was precise. He was careful. He was a very, very good scholar. He was impeccable in his behavior. He was like the model monk. And one day, he got very sick, really sick, really ill, and they tried to help him and they couldn't, and he died. And everybody checked. He was gone. The man is dead. It happens. He was laid out in a storeroom while they were getting the cremation ready. They're outside, kind of building the funeral pyre because they, you know, burn bodies. And all of a sudden, and he's there, and people come and look at him. He's dead. There's no color in his face. He stopped breathing like 2 days ago. He's gone. And all of a sudden, the shutters burst open. There was a window on the, in this sort of storeroom. And he jumps out. And from that moment until he died, he was like the blazing sun of enlightenment. And people had two responses to him. He was very much like Jamgon Kuntral, only more so. And people had two responses. Either they loved him with their whole heart, and people said being around him was, it was, oh my God, it was so difficult being around him because there was no hiding. You could not hide. And the other response was people hated him and talked badly about him and spread rumors about him, but he really didn't care. He couldn't have cared less. And Jamgon Kuntral sent Trungpa Rinpoche to study with Kenpo Gangchar, this completely out there person. I mean, the man was living in a state of realization and directness and love. And Trungpa Rinpoche studied with him, I think, for about a year and a half. And Trungpa Rinpoche, I mean, living close to that kind of blazing sanity, you're never going to be the same again. And Trungpa Rinpoche said that was it. You know, that really, you know, at the end of that time, he really understood what this lineage is about. This lineage in this room, he understood what it was about. And it took a few years before the whole thing with the Chinese happened, and he went to England and so on. But it was in him. And he was in his late teens when this happened, and he was biding his time until it was time for him to actually begin to teach other people the lineage. When the Chinese invaded Tibet and it became clear that they had to escape, they had to leave or they'd be killed, people like Trungpa Rinpoche would have been killed. He went to India and began to learn English, and, you know, I mean, they were all, the Tibetans didn't know what was going on. You know, they were completely confused at that time and trying to figure out what's happening and how are they going to live. And he got a scholarship and went to England. So far, so good. You know, he gets to England, he's at Oxford, he's learning English, he's taking classes, he's learning about Western culture. And he and a friend of his named Akong Toku, a boyhood friend, actually, they grew up together in the monastery in Scotland, somebody gave them a sort of Scottish manor house, which is called Samye Ling. They named it Samye Ling. So they established a monastery there, and it wasn't a huge place, but it was big enough to, you know, teach and have students. And so English students started coming and so on, but there was a little bit of a problem because Trungpa Rinpoche began to realize that the English students, most of them did not want the Dharma. They did not want this lineage. And what they wanted was, they wanted to have their little Tibetan guru and go up on the weekends and hang around and be spiritual and get teachings and then go back to wherever, London, wherever. But they didn't really want the Dharma. They liked the fact that he was, you know, this Tibetan, and they would talk about, oh, we have this Tibetan guru, this Rinpoche. And at that time, there weren't very many Tibetans around. It was very kind of like cachet, you know, to be studying with Trungpa Rinpoche. But Trungpa Rinpoche knew that that wasn't it. So he started pushing the boundaries. I mean, he saw through it. He saw this is complete bullshit. You know, this is, I was not brought up to maintain Tibetan culture. That's not what I was here for. I was trained by my teacher to deliver the Dharma, and the Dharma touches every human being has the Dharma in them, and this lineage is about awakening that Dharma in them. And so there started to be a real problem in this monastery. It was a question of integrity. What is the integrity of the Dharma? Is it the nakedness of our state of being? Is it about our life? Or is it about maintaining a set of values and a set of, Asian traditions? Is that what it's about? There was a huge conflict. Meantime, Trungpa Rinpoche was giving his English students, he was just like doing it, like we do it here. Nobody's holding back around here. Well, that was his style from the very beginning. He taught them the Dharma, the true Dharma, the naked Dharma. He didn't give them a lot of sort of palliatives and band-aids and, you know, things to keep their mind occupied. And he gave back his robes. You know, he took his robes off. He dressed as a layperson. And he started actually having personal relationships with his students, men and women. Personal relationships, which, you know, from our modern standpoint, what's the big deal? But in Tibet, you did not do that. You did not have personal relationships with your students because you were too high. And if one of your students came in to see you, they would have to go like this and not breathe in your direction. You know, they breathe like this, and, oh, your holiness is so high, and I'm such a little piece of turd on the floor. But, you know, that's a way the patriarchy has of maintaining itself, and it's a way that the hierarchy has of maintaining itself. You don't show people that you're an actual person. It's just how it goes. And it's not just Tibetan Buddhism, but Asian Buddhism in general. There's a huge gap between lay people like ourselves and the so-called holy people. And, you know, so Rinpoche just, he saw that that's not the real Dharma. And he was a scholar himself, and he knew that in the day of the Buddha hung around with his students. They talked about things. They got sick together. They got well together. The police were after them. There was a time when somebody dumped a corpse in the monastery and tried to say that the Buddhist monks had killed this person. I mean, they had real human situations they had to deal with. And Rinpoche was far more inspired by that than he was by this traditional, you know, separation that he found in his own culture. And Rinpoche, his thing was, the lineage is in my heart. And he actually said on a number of occasions, if I can't teach the Dharma to my Western students, then I want to die. I want to die. So Rinpoche was actually prevented from teaching. And Trungpa Rinpoche was at the end of his rope. And he had met Diana, you know, the woman he eventually married. And one night he actually wanted to kill himself because he felt like, if I can't teach, then I'm not, there's no point in my being alive. And he actually tried to kill himself. And Diana got in the way. She stopped it. But that's where he was at. And he had no students. He had no credentials. He was vilified. All the Tibetans were talking against him, which I know myself because I went to India actually after Rinpoche came to this country. I went to India 2 years later, and people were talking down. They were bad-mouthing him and criticizing him, and all these rumors, half of which weren't true, being spread. He was being vilified. So it happened. And he... now what? No money. He wanted to come to America, but he had no money. They had nothing, he and Diana. So, you know, they're out. And the University of Colorado sent him a plane ticket. That's interesting. To come and teach in Colorado. Somebody sent him a plane ticket, but he was invited to come and teach in America. And that's why he came. That's why he came to America, because he knew he had to come, but he had no way to do it. And so he came. But when I met him in 1970, which was literally a couple of weeks after he arrived in the United States, what I met was this lineage. Now, later, I heard about all the politics and all the, well, that's not really the real lineage because, you know, we have these official titles and we have this system in Tibet, you know, which is the way it goes now. Don't you think it's interesting that virtually no Westerners have been permitted to be lineage holders in Tibetan Buddhism? They're hanging on like this. And Trungpa Rinpoche, what I'm trying to say here is he was different. He was different. His thing was the Dharma. And when he arrived, he said, I'm here because I want to teach the lineage of the Buddha that has come down in an unbroken stream since the time of the Buddha. And this lineage is alive and it will make you free. And I'm offering it to you here. All you have to do is make a relationship with it and work on yourself. And we were out there. I mean, if you see some of the videos from 1970 and 71, we were crazy. We were so out there. We were like no boundaries and drugs and, you know, like craziness, you know, everywhere. But the thing is, we were open. And there were, of every 100 people that heard Trungpa Rinpoche speak, there were about 5 that said, this is what I've been looking for my whole life. He met a lot of people the first couple of years because he traveled around. And he was, again, Tartang Tulku was the only other Tibetan who was in the United States, living in the United States. And so the two of them were it. I mean, if you weren't interested in Tibetan Buddhism, it was one of those two. And he really attracted people, and there were articles about him. And so a lot of people heard him speak. But 95% of the people who heard him speak said, that's really interesting, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. It's too scary. It's too wild. It's too open. I've got my little thing going. But there were 5 people out of every 100 that said, this is what I've been looking for my whole life, and I am going to do it. And I will do it, and I'll give anything up, you know, to study with you. I had that opportunity, you know, within weeks. There were 4 people living at Karma Chuling, 2 of whom dropped out, and the other of one went insane. So that was interesting. And so it was a very small scene, but it started, this trickle started, and these people started coming around, being around. And this, what you're hearing here, is what, that's what he taught us. And that's what he asked of us. So, for me, that's the lineage. That's the beginning and the end of it. And all the conversation we hear about the politics and about, you know, this person's really lineageal and that person isn't. I mean, Rinpoche's thing was, the way you find out who a lineage holder is, you listen to them teach. That's how you find out. It's not by the how high their throne is, or, you know, how expensive their robes are, or how many other Rinpoches bow down to them. That's not how you find out. You find out by listening to them teach. It's really straightforward. It's really simple. And, of course, he was saying that, and meantime, you know, we're starting to find out that he's really persona non grata in Tibetan Buddhism. And you know what? It fit in with the 60s mentality, the 70s mentality, that the establishment is full of shit. Which I think, you know, in most cases the establishment is full of shit. But the thing is, for us, if you were part of the establishment, it was automatic, we weren't interested in you. So it was a little too extreme. But in our case, hearing that the whole Tibetan, you know, this monolithic, brutal Tibetan culture was not what Trungpa Rinpoche was doing, was actually very, it was a great relief to us, actually, a tremendous amount of relief.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Our music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Kechog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.